Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Listen Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now here's your host and producer, Sherry Brackett.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. Today we're airing part two of our conversation with Hawaii County Prosecuting Attorney Mitch Roth. One thing I did not mention last week, but I do want to mention this week, is that Prosecuting Attorney Roth has received an award from the Law Enforcement and Security Coalition of Hawaii. This was awarded on October 25th. It was for outstanding service, support, and assistance that has benefited the fields of law enforcement, private security, or criminal justice. They cited the case of Peter Boykema, which we talked about last week, and the award also noted the aggressive stance that Prosecutor Roth and his team are taking in charging suspects who are accomplices to the murder of the Hawaii County police officer Kalaeloa. So congrats to Mitch Roth and to his entire team. Last week in part one, we talked a little bit about child abuse, the role of the prosecutor, how the prosecutor handles cases in which there's a conflict, whether it involves the police or another prosecutor or whatever. We talked about privacy rights. We talked about bail and the specific situation of the criminal Justin Waikei. Hawaii County prosecutors had recommended that a higher bail be set for Mr. Waikei. A judge chose to lower it. Justin Waikei got out and shot and killed Officer Bronson Kalaeloa, and we take that matter up again today. And we'll also talk about car theft, sexual assault, domestic violence, and some of the positive programs that County Prosecutor Roth has going. Let's get into our conversation with Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth. Back to the Justin Waikei case, several listeners had asked me a question, and I'll ask you this question. As I said, the county prosecutor, your office, recommended a higher bail for Justin Waikei. A judge chose to lower it, and as we know, Justin Waikei went on to shoot and kill Officer Bronson Kalaeloa. Should we be holding this judge responsible for the death of Bronson Kalaeloa? Should we be holding the judge responsible for perhaps making a decision that was not in the best interest of the community?
We are all human beings, and you know, we don't get things right all the time. In my mind, do I think this judge, who is Judge Nakamoto, who had this case, wonderful person. I think he's a really good man. I think if he knew what was going to happen, then he wouldn't have done that.
Of course.
But if you think about this, in Judge Nakamoto's defense, if you go to the Department of Public Safety and the Corrections Division, you can pull this up, Hawaii Department of Public Safety, Corrections, and you can see the monthly count that they have. And you'll see the very first jail that they have on the list is HCCC, Hawaii Community Correctional Facility. And you'll see for the end of the month of July 2018, 2 months ago, they may have a new one up there by the time we look at this, you'll see that Hawaii Community Correctional Facility was made to hold, I think, 206 people, that the maximum capacity is 226 people, and that the number of people that they have is somewhere around 417 people.
And you've talked about this before, that our jails are woefully overcrowded.
They're woefully overcrowded. So the judge has to say, you know, what do I know? What do I have? You know, we're making this argument. We always believe that the judge should believe us because we're trying to play the game up and up and fair. And the judge has to look at this and make a decision. So should you hold someone responsible for a mistake that they did that was an honest mistake in their mind? Was he within his bounds of doing that? He was absolutely within his bounds of doing that. So the answer is no, because if we're going to do that, then there's a lot that you can hold me responsible for
and everybody
that I just
else
haven't told you about.
Oh, well. Okay, next question is, so tell me about all the things we should hold you responsible for, joking.
And I know you're joking, but I'll say this. I looked back at Mr. Waikei. I saw that there was a case in the past that for whatever reason, whether it was the investigation wasn't great or decision of the deputy prosecutor or the, what was going on with the victim or what was going on in that case, we felt that we couldn't charge a case that happened several years ago in which Mr. Wyke choked his girlfriend, strangled his girlfriend.
Did she die?
No, she didn't die. And I look at this and I probably was harder on myself on that case. Probably we didn't have enough to go forward at that time. For whatever reason, the deputy didn't feel that there was enough. Right now, we're looking at those cases a lot differently when somebody strangles an intimate partner. And the reason why we're looking at those cases is in the last couple of years, we've started to see research. And one of the things that comes out in the research is police officers who have been killed across the nation from any person, about 50% of those people who killed a police officer had strangled an intimate partner in the past.
Wow.
Now think about that for a second. That's a pretty scary thought. And we actually have a team of people now that are starting to look at those cases and say, you know what? We may not be able to make this. Let's look a little bit harder. Let's try to dig a little bit more. You know, we get maybe 500 domestic violence cases open at any one time. We're looking at those cases where strangulation has occurred because if someone's going to strangle their intimate partner, there's a much bigger likelihood that they're a bigger danger than we'd earlier thought.
And that also points up how important it is for you guys to have access to research that tells you things that you might not be able to discern just from looking at, right, you know, X number of cases every year.
Right. And, you know, going to back to that, I just want to stay on the domestic violence because I think, unfortunately, I had a conversation earlier today with someone. We were talking on our walk about how domestic violence is really the root of a lot of our problems. But so many people in our community feel that this is a woman's issue and not a community issue. You know, that's a big deal to me, that people need to understand that this is not a woman's issue. This is a community issue. And we know that we have a suicide epidemic on this island. Kids coming from homes of domestic violence are 6 times more likely to commit suicide than kids not coming from homes of domestic violence. Sex assault, far greater if they come from a home of domestic violence. Drug and alcohol abuse, far greater coming from homes of domestic violence. You look at, you know, the drug problems that we have, a lot of those things go back to domestic violence. You know, and for so long, we've been looking at this as, oh, you know, it's a woman's problem. Why doesn't she just leave? You know, we're not asking the right questions and we're not giving the right amount of attention to these issues. And so we're trying to change some of those stuff. That when we feel that we can improve the system, we're trying to make those changes. But it's difficult.
Well, you and I have talked about domestic violence before, and I haven't talked to you on the radio at least for a year. So what's happened in the past year to make a difference in the domestic violence situation on this island?
Well, you know, we still have it happening. I was blessed to have this new attorney who came in about a year ago. Her name is Susanna Tiapula, wonderful woman. She worked at the National District Attorneys Association. She was a director of human trafficking, which is, I know you're not asking about human trafficking, but she's also put on a lot of trainings around the area of domestic violence and looking at these cases. And she said, I want to see all the cases where we have strangulation. So we started looking at those and we're more aware of those cases. And she's taking some of those cases and saying, hey, I want to handle this case myself. And she's training some of our deputies on how to do a better job in these cases. It's difficult. I mean, it's not a single solution.
Well, the other kind of case that I think is particularly difficult that you and I have also talked about is sexual assault.
Oh, yeah.
And right before Police Chief Kubojiri left office, before current police chief took over, he and I had talked about untested rape kits. And at that time, there were X number from Hawaii County that were not tested, and they were sent to Honolulu. Finally, all of the rape kits have been tested by the Honolulu Police Department or other agencies. And I know that you, I believe, hired a prosecutor specifically to look at sexual assault cases as well. So where are we with sexual assault? Because we're not hearing a lot about that. We're not hearing a lot, it seems, about prosecutions, or maybe we are, and I'm just not paying attention. I can tell from the look on your face.
I'm shocked, Sherry. We've had more sex assault cases going through the system now than ever in the past. We created a sex assault team, and they're doing some pretty great work. There's a lot of stuff that's been happening with them. But with the sex assault kits, we wrote for a grant, and I just found out in the last week that we're going to be receiving a grant to bring in another deputy for, I think, a 10-month period and a investigator to start looking at those Saki kits. You know, we have sent those kits. I think there's 189 cases that were tested that we had in Hawaii County. Some of those cases, I believe, we've started to get some results back. But just saying that doesn't really tell the story. A lot of those cases we had, identification wasn't an issue. So,
meaning you knew who the perpetrator was?
Sure. If there's a sex assault case between Bob and Sally, where Bob is sexually assaulting Sally, Sally's saying that she was raped by Bob, and Bob says it was consensual.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Well, if it's consensual, what do you need DNA for? What does DNA give you? So now the argument is, well, if we had the DNA test, so we put into the CODIS system, which is the national system that looks back and, you know, you start looking at these cases.
Meaning you can find another case where the same individual might have been involved.
Correct.
Or more cases.
But that being said, if Bob gets convicted of the sex assault case, then we take his DNA and we put it into the CODIS system. So you have some of those cases. The other thing that happens is that some victims just really don't want to go forward. You know, I don't want to get into victim blaming. There's lots of reasons why.
Well, it's the same thing as in domestic violence. They're personal, they're intimate cases,
right.
They're sensitive. It's not that easy. And also, I think some victims have fear of retribution from the person
right.
who they're accusing.
We're going to be looking at every one of those cases. And we've made that commitment that we want to go back. We want to study these cases. We want to see what happens. And even some of those cases, statute of limitation ran, but we want to see if maybe if we had some hits, maybe we want to put those into CODIS as well to bring it up so someone else in someplace else has a sex assault case with this person. They can go back and say, hey, this guy was in CODIS for this, wasn't convicted, but was never brought. Maybe the victim would come forward and testify on that.
A sort of unrelated crime that folks ask about is automobile theft, because there are a lot of automobile thefts on this island. And from what the police tell me, and you have also told me in the past, a lot of this, it's the same people who
yeah.
steal a car, they get arrested, they go to jail, they get out, they steal a car, and it's an endless cycle. Is there a long-term solution? How can we keep car thieves off the street?
Well, first off, you are correct. It is unrelated to sex assault.
Yes.
One of the things that really frustrates me and many of the deputies in our office is that a lot of people in the criminal justice system see car theft, burglary, theft in general as property crimes versus crimes against people. And because of the lack of space in our jails and our prison, the judges are less likely to put those people in jail. However, you know, we put together a team together with the police. The police have their special enforcement unit. We have deputies that have been working very closely with them that have been focusing on the people that have been stealing cars. Most of those people who we identified have been locked up. As we lock those people up, the crimes go down. We're hoping that those same people, when they get out, are not committing more crimes. Unfortunately, the rate of recidivism is not great. And so it's really saying, what can you do in jails, in prisons, to improve those numbers? Now, generally, that's not the prosecutor's kuleana. However, I will say that we do have a program where we're going into the jail and we're working on some of those things. But I think we need to have a more holistic approach to look at these things. And we got to get rid of these Grand Theft Auto games. And now people are going to write into you, call into you, what about Grand Theft Auto? I mean, that really, we're glorifying for a lot of our younger generation stealing cars. That's what Grand Theft Auto is, shooting cops. That's what these games and what our society is doing. We live on an island. It's not like people are stealing cars and chopping them up and selling them. It does happen. But generally, they're taking them out and they're doing what they do on video games. And so we need to change that dynamic. We need to change the family dynamic. most of those things are really not the role of the prosecutor, but I think it's all of our roles as a community. There's a great quote by a guy named Sir Robert Peel, who's the father of modern-day policing. He's the guy that in England they call the Bobbies after him, also the Peelers, named after Sir Robert Peel. Coppers had nothing to do with Sir Robert Peel. Had to do with the copper buttons that they have. Now the police are so poor, they have plastic buttons, so we call them the Popo. But Sir Robert Peel said this. He said, "The police are the public are the police, with the police being the only members of society that are paid to do what's incumbent upon every citizen." So I reach out to these people who are listening to your audience here and say, look, this is all of our responsibility to do something. And if you expect it to be solved by the police and the prosecutors or even government, I don't think that that's going to happen. It's got to be a change in our culture and what we do and what we respect and how we respect each other as family and friends and people living in a state and on an island together.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues, and I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer. Today, we are in part two of our conversation with Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth. You may hear part one online at lava1053.com or at coacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. And that's for last week's and other previous Island Issues interviews. Next Sunday morning, we're going to be talking about vaping. We talked briefly about it a few weeks ago, but next week we'll talk in more detail with Sally Anchetta of the Hawaii Public Health Institute, Forrest Batts, who's also with Hawaii Public Health Institute, but from the College of Pharmacy, bringing in some of the health aspects, and Kevin Ramirez on what the Hawaii Public Health Institute is doing to deter young people from picking up this habit, which is an addiction to nicotine. That's next Sunday morning. Let's get back to County Prosecutor Mitch Roth. Well, you mentioned that sometimes people look at automobile theft as a property crime, but it really is a crime against people. Oh, one person I talked to, she said, "I'm afraid to leave my car at one of the big box stores. I'm afraid it's going to be taken, and I really, really love my car." You know, a car is part of what we need these days to be part of our lives.
Again, you know, when you're looking to the judiciary and you're looking at what they're seeing in front of them, as far as, you know, you have someone who's getting savagely beaten, and then you have someone whose car has been broken into or his house. I totally get it. My house has been broken into, and I'll tell you, when someone's car is stolen or when someone's house is broken into, they tell you the same thing that our sex assault victims tell us, that they feel violated. They feel, you know, they don't feel safe in their own home. And so, you know, people are taking more than just a thing. They're taking that sense of security and you know, if I had a golden wand and I can change the world, you know, I would try to keep all these people in who commit these crimes. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen with the current state of affairs, current state of our economy and our legislative body, who is at every effort, it seems, trying to make crimes more lenient, the penalties for crimes more lenient, the things that we have to do as prosecutors to prove our case rather than making it easier, it's becoming a more and more difficult job to do.
It is. You know, I listen to you enough, and I do know that it's a challenge. I'm going to change topics again, and okay. I'm going to move to something that's very recent in everybody's minds, and let's knock on wood and hope it's still recent and not current, and that is the lava flow.
That's over with.
Yeah, we hope it stays over with. As when we air this, that it's still over with. You and I talked at the time the lava flow started about the penalties for people who were trespassing into the lava flow. And there were arrests. There were several arrests. And I'm curious, in general, what's the state of those cases? Are they able to be prosecuted?
A lot of those cases have been prosecuted. There's been a lot of $500 fines that were given. And we looked at some of those cases, and some of those cases were also dismissed for various reasons. And you know, I had a lot of people making calls, and some of them, you know, when looking to some of the cases, they had some good reasons. Some of the cases I looked in and just said, that's total BS. This person wasn't there because, you know, they were going home or something. So,
well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask. There were some people who actually were trying to get back to their property, even though they theoretically were not allowed to do so.
Yeah. And it really depends. Some of those cases, we went forward and we prosecuted. And the reason why we went forward and prosecuted is because, in my mind, we had to keep our community safe and our first responders safe. I was in the EOC civil defense one night, and I was watching as there was a drone up, and there was somebody who was at their house, and they were flashing their lights, SOS, SOS. And I was watching people on Facebook say, oh, so-and-so says a helicopter's coming. Stay there. And this guy's typing back and forth, and people are telling him, and it's like, there's no helicopter coming. We had to put people in harm's way. And I try to look at those cases. I have my deputies look at those cases and make a real decision that there's a reason that the mayor and the governor and civil defense said you're not going in. And, you know, part of that was to save human lives. And some people thought that the law doesn't apply to them. And some people had, you know, some really compelling stories. And so some cases were dismissed, and there's cases that we're still prosecuting. And sometimes there were some issues that we said, you know, this didn't work out right, and so we've taken every case kind of on an individual basis, and I've generally left that to the deputies who are handling those cases to look at that. But for the first couple months, I said nobody's getting off with any of these things. So we just put them to trial and stuff like that, and then they started coming back, and I did hear some stories and did see some things where I said, you know, good example, we had a case the other day where civil defense actually wanted this person in there. And so, okay, if civil defense gave them the right to be there, then that's a whole different matter.
Of course, they should have told the police or whoever had to do the arrest that, so the police.
And sometimes they did tell the police and DLNR, and because things were happening, there were some communication breakdowns.
Okay, good. So moving on, one of the things I know that you have been particularly focused on is you don't really want to have to prosecute people. You don't want people to commit crimes in the first place. And one way you have talked about starting is with our young people who are offenders. And you started some kind of a teen intake center, I believe in Hilo, and then it spread to Kona for youthful juvenile offenders. Tell us a little bit about that.
So let me just go back on a little bit. I want to make sure we're prosecuting the right people, first of all. I have no problem with prosecuting, but I want to keep the numbers down. I don't think if I could work myself out of a job, that would be wonderful, you know, that we'd have nobody breaking the law. I would be so happy with that. But we've started looking at juveniles and said, you know, we can do things a lot better. And the whole idea was going upstream to figure out how do you keep these people from just keep on, the numbers keep on going up. And one of the things we did is we realized that when kids were getting arrested, it was taking about a year for those cases to go through the system. And so if you're arrested at 15, it doesn't get to the prosecutor's office for 3 months, and then it doesn't get out of the prosecutor's office for 3 months, and then, you know, another couple of months to serve the kid. And then, you know, there's a continuance, so they get this. 15 years old, commits a crime, 16, kid doesn't understand. So we helped bring what's called the BIJAC, Big Island Juvenile Intake and Assessment Center, to the Big Island. So now when the police arrest a kid, they bring them to the BIJAC. We have one in Hilo and one in Kona.
And this is anybody who's under 18 years old?
Under 18 years old. And at the BIJAC, they do an assessment. They find out what the kid needs. And we're still going through a lot of times with these cases, but we're getting the services up front, and you have the, not so much a punishment or a consequence, but you get what needs to happen, which happens a lot of times in juvenile court. So by the time they get to juvenile court, if they've gone through the drug treatment or they've gone through the family planning or they've gone through, you know, what they need to do, then, you know, the sentence is going to be a lot less. What we've noticed is that when we send kids to our kids' jail on Oahu, the Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility, HYCF, the recidivism rate's about 75%. And for that, you pay $200,000 per kid per year, maybe a little bit more than $200,000 per kid. That's a lot of money. If you get a 25, that's 25% success rate, that's a fail. So with BIJAC, we're seeing our numbers are somewhere around 95% success, that not recidivating, about a 5% recidivism rate.
And that's excellent, because that means they potentially are on the path to being a productive member of our community.
And you know, all of us have done stupid things when we were a kid. And luckily, I think all of us, or most of us, had consequences from our parents, because I grew up in a time where you couldn't do something and get home quick enough before your parents knew. And I know a lot of your listeners are probably nodding, oh, yeah, that was me. You know, now nobody knows their neighbors. They don't, you know, know what's going on with these kids. And so if you can get some kind of consequences, something up front, generally kids are, you can get them back on track. And they still go through the system, and sometimes they have to have other consequences like restitution, maybe probation, things like that. But if you can keep them out of the system, that's great. Another thing we're doing some restorative justice stuff that I'm blessed to have this guy, Tim Hansen, who works in our office, who just does an amazing job with restorative justice. He does these victim offender dialogues. A lot of people don't realize this. If you're a victim of a juvenile and you go to family court, some kid, let's say, stole something from you, we can't tell you what his sentence says. And so you may not even know. It's like, other than it's over, oh, and now you're getting this apology letter that's kind of like half-baked. It's like, what is this? Oh, yeah, we can't tell you what happened other than, you know, what the consequence is. With our restorative justice measures, we ask our victims in certain cases if they'd be willing to do this conversation, and the kid and the victim get to discuss and come up with what kind of consequences there are. The victim has to want to do it, and the kid who committed the crime has to want to do it. Where we've done this, what we've seen is we have a 0% recidivism rate.
Really?
Yeah. We have a 100% at this time, we have a 100% victim satisfaction. Why do you have 100%? Because the victim knows what's happening. And we have a 100% follow through by the kid who's committed these crimes. So we've been doing this for the last couple of years. We are just talking with the Attorney General's office to do case studies. We know that this has kind of worked in other places, but what we're seeing has been pretty amazing. On our restorative justice measures, we're also going into the jails. And by the way, let me before I go to the jails, we also do a program with adult offenders. Generally, it's not pretrial, but we can do it pretrial. We have done a couple of those, and we've also had 100% victim satisfaction.
But it's the same kind of thing, where the victim gets to talk to the perpetrator and essentially say, this is how you hurt me. This is how it affected my life in a negative way.
And then the offender also gets to explain what was going through their mind. And, you know, most people, they're victims of a crime of a kid, and they sit in front of that kid. If they want to sit in front of that kid, generally they're not too concerned about sending the kid to HYCF and having him, you know, mess up his life, put him into the chain of going from a kid offender to an adult offender. If they can make a difference, they want to make a difference. And if they can get restitution restored, then they're generally for that. And so we've seen some great things come out of that. With adults, we had some cases with murder cases, not that they're getting off, but we're allowing the victim and the murderer to talk. Many times it's maybe 20 years into their sentence, but that's a healing for both the victim and for the offender to have that conversation. Doesn't happen in very many cases, but you know, having that restorative part has been pretty amazing, because most people, and I realize, and most people that we put in prison are coming out. Do we want them to commit more crimes, or do we want them to be contributing members of society? Because just going through prison is not going to make them a contributing member of society. We know 50% of those people are going back in.
At least.
So we have a program now called Victim Impact, where we have 14 classes. We bring victims who want to go into the jail. They talk to a group of inmates who are there for the 14 classes. We see that where this is done in other places, that there's a 34% reduction in recidivism. It's generally done by departments of public safety. We're the only prosecutor's office in the nation that's doing it. Because we're the prosecutor's office doing it, we have an array of victims. A lot of times on the mainland, when they're doing these things, they're using videos because public safety doesn't have victims. They have maybe one or two victims that will come in, but we have a victim in every class except for the one that I get to go into, because I get to talk to them about the other victims that they don't think about. And really, that's their family members, their kids. Like I said earlier, their kids have a 50% likelihood of going into the criminal justice system unless something happens, unless they make a change. And so we're waiting to see what our numbers are here. I'd be willing to put money that we're going to be doing much better than the 36% reduction in recidivism. I'm thinking somewhere around 50. And for me, if we can do that, we will be making a huge effort to make our community a safer and healthier place, because the fewer criminals out there breaking the law, the fewer crimes you're going to have, and the fewer crimes, you know, the safer and healthier the community is.
Eventually, you need fewer jails, and eventually...
Eventually. And that's a good point, you know, that you have to realize sometimes you need to do more to get less.
Mm-hmm. Well, so a question... Which victims are given the opportunity to do this? Do you invite all victims to take part in this kind of program?
So our victim witness counselors are talking. Generally, we have...
And these are folks in your office, victim witness counselors.
Counselors, right. So they'll be looking at different cases. And so the classes are generally broke down by types of crimes. So we have families of homicide victims that will go and talk. We have rape victims that will go and talk. We have property crime victims that will go and talk. You know, the really amazing thing is when they come back, we have a lunch at the end of the year for our victims who did this, and they talk about their experience and going out. And a lot of people don't realize this. You'll see grown men, big tattooed guys in these classes bawling their eyes out because they never realized what kind of harm they were doing to other people. It's just one of the amazing things that, that happens in these classes.
You know, as you were talking about that, you know, a previous topic we touched on was Justin Wyke, the man who killed our lovely officer Bronson Kaliloa. He had friends who helped him, and all of these friends appear to have been criminals before. And, you know, I was wondering at the time that occurred, what made these people think they would be doing a good thing by supporting this Justin Wyke, who had already demonstrated his willingness to kill a police officer? And I'm just wondering, a lot of these people were young people. If they had had this opportunity, maybe they would have made a different choice in their lives as well.
You know, I'll group them in with just about any of our criminal community that they had different things. You know, I didn't talk about one of the favorite things I like to talk about is Camp Agape, which is a camp that the church has put on, but our office has been very involved in helping in this camp for kids of incarcerated parents. So the third time I'll mention this, we know that those kids have a 50% likelihood of entering the criminal justice system if you don't put something in between. And so, you know, whether they're good kids, whether they're bad kids, whether they're whatever, we're looking at different ways to go upstream. One of the reasons I love coming on your program is you have great listeners out there, and someone may be saying, hey, how can I get involved to do some of these things? And it may be simple as volunteering for something like Camp Agape through your church, or it may be supporting kids going through you know, STEM activities, so science, technology, engineering, and math, and giving them those opportunities, working with kids. Because the more we do for our kids, and especially, you know, these kids, the less likely they're going to be criminals in the future, and the better our society is going to be and the safer and healthier it's going to be.
Mitch Roth, County Prosecutor, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Sherry.
Aloha.
Aloha.
And to our listeners, like Mitch said, our listeners are fabulous. Thank you so much for being with us, because without you, there's no need for Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us at info@labo105.com. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.